funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why don't Americans eat food caught in American waters? More than 90% of the fish we consume in this country is imported from abroad, despite the fact that we have tens of thousands of miles of coastlines, millions of miles of rivers, and some of the best-managed fisheries in the world. Much of the fish we do catch is immediately packed up and sent abroad on ice, effectively disconnecting our domestic seafood supply from our own ecosystem. Author Paul Greenberg joins us to talk about how this happened. He's a Pew Fellow in Marine Conservation and a fellow with the Blue Ocean Institute. His new book is called American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Paul, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So how much fish do we catch in this country every year, and what happens to it?
We put away about 9 billion pounds of seafood every year that we catch, but about 3 billion pounds of it gets sent abroad. And it's a pretty shocking statistic, especially when you look at it in light of how much seafood that we are eating that's imported. Something like, more, as you said, close to 90% of what we are eating is actually coming to us from other countries. So it's a very strange situation. But I should also add there's another wrinkle to the whole thing, which is that the seafood, a certain portion of the seafood that we export, like, for example, Alaska salmon, We catch in Alaska, we freeze it, we send it to China, they defrost it, bone it, refreeze it, and then send it back to us double frozen.
Wow. It seems like, and I know labor costs are lower, but it would seem like you're spending so much money to go through all that trouble that it would be more cost effective to pay American labor prices and do it here.
It would seem so. I ran the numbers recently because I did a piece for the Los Angeles Times about the California market squid, which is another product that gets 90% of it goes through this crazy process of export and reimportation. What I found was that it was about $1.40 a pound that doing the processing here in America would add to the cost. The labor prices in China are so much cheaper than what a good fish cutter would get here in the States, that it offsets considerably the cost of transportation. There's another component to this, though, which is that, as up and down the Texas coast and all up and down all of our coasts are gentrifying, and people don't seem to want to have things like fish processors, working fishing communities, oyster farms. They don't want them in their viewshed. And frankly, a lot of that kind of infrastructure, seafood infrastructure, is just getting priced out and can't afford to be on the shore where, frankly, I think it belongs.
What happens to the quality of seafood when it's frozen, defrosted, and then finally cooked?
Well, the thing is that freezing gets better and better. Freezing in the first place presents a problem for seafood. What happens is when you freeze something, ice crystals form, and they can rupture the cell membranes in the food that you're eating, whether it's vegetables or meat or fish. If you freeze it real quick, the ice crystals that form are smaller, and they are less likely to rupture it. But still, when you double freeze, you're busting up the infrastructure of the fish, and you're going to end up with something probably mushier than it was. Plus, there's also the other issue of what is really happening to a piece of fish when it is going to China, and what is it getting mixed up with, and how do we know, and how do we even trace that piece of fish from Alaska through a China processor and back to us? How do we even know that we're getting what we sent, if you see what I'm saying?
How does American demand for seafood compare with the rest of the world?
Well, so Americans used to be a lot fishier, although that data is kind of lost into the pre-digital era, and so it's not all of it is retrievable. But anecdotally, I was looking through some great old New York City menus from the 19th century, and you just see scads and scads of fish on the menus. Even the breakfast menus have a lot of fish. But today, we only eat, as Americans, about 15 pounds of seafood per person per year, which is minuscule and compared to the land food that we eat. We eat about 200 pounds of poultry, pork, beef, industrial-produced meats, and it's a pretty striking difference. If you look at, say, China and Japan and Korea, those countries are all having closer to 35, 40 pounds of seafood per person per year. Mm-hmm. So it's a marked difference from the rest of the world.
And it turns out the fish that we do crave tends to be pretty bland. We like fish stick fish.
We do. We do. You know, there's a term for it in the seafood industry. It's called whitefish. You know, somebody from New York like myself, when they first hear the term whitefish, they assume it's that smoked thing that we have on a bagel. But in fact, the seafood industry calls anything that's sort of bland and pale and flaky a white fish. And that is, you know, for example, our filet of fish sandwich is fat, used to be made out of Atlantic cod. But as, you know, Mark Kurlansky famously told in his book Cod, those stocks were really seriously overfished. And so that now the filet of fish sandwich is more likely than not to be Alaska pollock, which is the largest edible finfish fishery in America at this point. Meanwhile, there are all these other white-fleshed fish that are coming into this country, tilapia, Pangasius catfish. You know, Pangasius catfish, which most Americans have never heard of, is actually the sixth most consumed seafood in America. And it's consumed that much without our knowing it because it is so bland. It's just a white fish that you fry, that you put between a bun or shape into a stick.
Right. And, of course, we have the crab with a K, which is also not shellfish. It is some kind of white fish mashed together with, I don't know, gelatin or something.
Exactly. That is Alaska pollock also. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the California roll has nothing to do with California. It has to do with Alaska pollock. And, weirdly, that's a very strange sort of transshipment of that one as well. For some reason, a lot of the pollock that gets made into fake crab goes into either Germany or the Netherlands, where perhaps they have some, you know, secret Germanic process of transforming fish into crab, and then it comes back to us from there, you know, with crab with a K.
Hmm. All right, I want to talk about oysters. These were once so abundant in the Northeast that people ate them daily, and now they're sort of a rare treat for those of us who eat them at all.
It's true, and, you know, those, like in the South, in Texas and Louisiana, I know that, you know, oysters are still quite common, and you still can come up against, you know, a 25-cent oyster. That still will occur sometimes. But in New York, it used to be like that. The average New York City resident used to eat, and this is around the turn of the 19th century, or 20th century, rather, they ate 600 local New York City-grown oysters per year. I mean, huge amount of oysters. And we had trillions upon trillions of oysters in the New York City estuary. And, in fact, you know, all up and down the East Coast, if you look at it, Philadelphia, Wilmington, Baltimore, Washington, these were all places where there were large wild oyster reefs. But a series of events has really changed that dynamic radically.
So what happened to all the oysters?
Well, so, you know, in New York, the first thing that happened was we over-harvested them. You know, when the settlers first came from Holland to New York City, which was, you know, the original settlement, they found giant oysters, some of them as big as a dinner plate. And I think it was Jonathan Swift who said that eating an American oyster was like eating a baby. It was so big. So we had all these tremendous oysters. We mined them out. Some of they were mined out often as much for food as they were for lime. The shells were burned down, turned into lime for building purposes. Some of it ground up, used as fertilizer. By 1820, New York City had lost all of its, not all of it, but most of its wild oyster reefs. But that didn't mean the end of New York oysters. After that came a tremendous effort to do farmed oysters. And it was a very early form of farming. They would transport smaller juvenile oysters from other estuaries and plant them in New York waters, grow them to size, and then harvest them. And this continued on and peaked around 1900. At one point, the East Coast was producing something like 2 billion pounds of oysters per year, and New York was a net exporter of oysters. But of course, you know, as the city grew, all the things associated with civilization grew. At one point, New York was putting out about 600 million gallons of raw sewage into the harbor every day. And some of the oyster beds got buried in sludge, sometimes 10 feet deep. Hmm. But the real thing that changed the dynamic was around the late 19th century is people started to understand the science behind epidemics. And they came to understand that sewage was carrying pathogens that were making it into oysters that were getting people sick. And by 1920, when a series of waves of epidemics, cholera, hepatitis, and so forth came about, that's when finally city officials said, you know, enough of this. We have to get rid of the oysters. And they closed the last beds off of Staten Island and off of Jamaica Bay. Once they were closed, once we no longer thought about New York City as a food system at all, that's when the real pollution started. That's when all the post-war industrial effluent, heavy metals, dioxin from the manufacture of Agent Orange, all these really horrible things went into the water and continued to do so until the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972.
Oysters, I didn't realize until I read your book, they're pretty remarkable little creatures in terms of the way they interact with the ecosystem.
They are amazing. I mean, a single oyster can filter 50 gallons of water a day. So you can imagine, you know, earlier I was saying that, you know, there were trillions in New York Harbor. Imagine what trillions of oysters will do for your water quality if they're all, you know, filtering away, clearing the water, 50 gallons per oyster per day. It's a lot. But in addition to that, there's an interesting thing which oysters do. Is oysters are one of the only shellfish that build in three dimensions. I think they might be the only one, actually. And what that means is they build kind of like fish condominiums. They have great like nooks and crannies for juvenile fish to hang out in, great habitat. And in fact, in New York City, where I'm from, there's a port called Sheepshead Bay. And it's called Sheepshead Bay because once upon a time we had a fish down there, which you have in Texas, called the Sheepshead Porgy. Sheepshead Porgy, if you look at it, has these big chomping teeth. And the reason they have those teeth is that they ate oysters. Surprise, surprise, we don't have oysters in Sheepshead Bay anymore, and nor do we have Sheepshead. So loss of oysters greatly reduces the potential for your home waters to carry fish and to be seafood-producing places.
What does it take for an oyster reef to form naturally?
So oysters begin their lives as what are called veligers. They're free swimming, and they swim through the water column, and they look for a combination of things, but one of the things they key in on is a chemically basic signal that's coming from some element in the bottom. The best thing that really attracts them is actually other oyster shell. So if they sense the chemical baseness in the water, they will drop. And then they will become a footed veliger. They'll grow a single foot, attach to that substrate for the rest of their lives, and grow into an oyster. And then when they die, another oyster will fall on them and grow on top of them, and then so on and so on and so on. And that's how you get these amazing structures that are sort of the temperate water equivalent of coral reefs.
How do they make baby oysters?
Sorry?
How do they make baby oysters?
The males release the equivalent of sperm, the females eggs. But what's interesting is that oysters actually change gender in the course of their lives. My friend, the great oyster promoter, John Rowley, he likes to say they're her today, guy tomorrow. But then I looked into it, and it's actually the other way around. So I think you would say he today, girl tomorrow is the best way to say it. So they change gender. They emit, you know, their spawn into the water. And it's actually one of the problems with trying to restore oysters to New York is that, you know, in the Chesapeake Bay, for example, there is still enough wild oyster production around that if you build some structure, you put some bags of oyster shell, there's enough spawn out there, enough free-swimming veligers out there that they will find the shell and they'll set and you can actually start an oyster reef that way. In New York, we've lost the engine of oyster reproduction. So in the book, In American Catch, I spent some time with this institution called the New York Harbor School, which has actually started an oyster nursery on Governor's Island in the harbor with the idea of trying to restart that reproductive engine so that there'd be this flow of larvae that would get out into the harbor and then building structures around the harbor where that spawn can actually set.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break here. My guest is Paul Greenberg, author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Paul Greenberg. He's a Pew Fellow in Marine Conservation and a fellow with the Blue Ocean Institute. His new book is called American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Paul, before the break, you were telling us about the New York Harbor School's efforts to establish reestablish oyster reefs around Governor's Island.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing project. I mean, it's not just the Harbor School. It's like 30 different organizations. You wouldn't believe the kind of crackpots that get out in favor of trying to restore oysters. There are sculptresses. There are, you know, actresses. It's, for some reason, it just draws all the people, all the crazy New Yorkers out of the woodwork. But I think that's great because, you know, it's this missing component of the New York City estuary that we lost years ago, and it's great that the memory of it is coming back enough so that it brings, you know, the average New Yorker down to the waterfront again.
You found a wild oyster in the Bronx.
I did indeed, and I'm ashamed to say I ate it.
And it wasn't, like, it wasn't looking good, right?
Well, you know, the thing is, you know, so it was what they would call in the oyster trade a single. It wasn't attached to a reef. Somehow it had managed to survive, and I should note that, you know, oysters, you know, the terms of terrestrial environments somehow unfairly invade marine environments in that people are always talking about extinction of bluefin tuna, extinction of New York oysters. These things aren't extinct. They're just severely repressed.
Hmm.
So there are actually probably, you know, hundreds of thousands of New York oysters left, but they're in isolated tiny clumps, nowhere near what they were. So, yes, in fact, I did find a New York oyster, and kind of as a dare to myself, I did eat it. And kind of also out of frustration, because for years, as people were trying to restore oysters to New York, so many different regulatory agencies were throwing up barriers to it. You know, even in New Jersey, when the Christie administration came in, the new head of the Department of Environmental Conservation, or the new administration, basically stopped an oyster restoration project in Keyport Harbor in New Jersey and demanded that the nascent reef that had been started be ripped up and thrown in the garbage, and that's exactly what they did. So when I ate that oyster in the Bronx, it was kind of out of protest. And as I often say, it's, you know, I'm a professional writer. Don't try this at home. it's only for somebody who's really, truly, you know, ready to go to the line for the oyster.
So talk about this. There is, I mean, oysters are delicious, and they used to be part of the ecosystem. They also can serve a function as we try to find ways to cope with climate change and rising sea levels.
Yeah, and, you know, I should say this is a little, you know, controversial and debated, but one of the great people I met in the course of this research was a woman named Kate Orff, who coined the term oyster texture. Mm-hmm. And if you actually go online and you Google her TED Talk, she goes on fairly great length about it. But so Kate's idea is that oysters, you know, as I mentioned earlier, grow living reefs. They grow in three dimensions. And if you let them grow, they can do a certain amount in terms of storm mitigation and protection from flooding. They're never going to grow, you know, like to the size of like the Hoover Dam or something. But if you put them in strategic areas, extend a breakwater, for example, with an oyster reef, or let Jamaica Bay, which sits in front of some very, very fragile seaside communities in Brooklyn and Queens, if you let that shallow out and put oysters in there, it will act as a baffling device that will, when you get a storm surge, will decrease the flow and the speed of water and possibly limit storm surge and do something for coastal protection. So I thought that was a really neat idea. They're actually now launching a few pilot projects of oyster texture since Hurricane Sandy hit. So who knows? Maybe we'll see these sort of living, growing breakwaters appear throughout the United States as we see this as a way of biologically confronting climate change and seawater rise.
Okay, I'm 43, and when I was a kid, shrimp was like a big treat. It was sort of a special occasion food.
Yep.
And now it's everywhere.
Yep. Well, I'm 47. I remember the same thing. It was like one of those things where, you know, you had, like, remember the shrimp cocktail? That
right.
was, like, usually where we saw it.
Like three like, shrimp in the, right.
And a wedge of lemon and uh-huh. cocktail sauce. Like, that was your shrimp for the day. Yeah, now it's everywhere. So this really is the result of the internationalization of shrimp, and particularly having to do with aquaculture, or you know, marine farming, as you know, it's often called, just generally referred to as aquaculture. But so once upon a time, all the shrimp that we had was wild. But starting in around 1945 or so, there was a Japanese scientist named Dr. Fujinaga, and he had this vision that shrimp could be this really great thing that you could farm, and it would provide all this protein for protein-deprived places. He started in on trying to domesticate a kind of shrimp called the kuruma prawn, and this was a shrimp that was most commonly eaten by wealthy people in Japan at the time in a dish called dancing shrimp. And in dancing shrimp, what you would do is you'd rip off the carapace of the shrimp while it was still alive, dip it in sake, and then pop it in your mouth. So, you know, I know people out there like fresh sushi, but this is like taken to a ridiculous extreme. Anyway, Dr. Fujinaga figured out how to domesticate that shrimp. And he was also, he was a sort of an interesting guy. He was very internationalist in his approach to the world. And he brought in a lot of graduate students from around the world, mostly from Southeast Asia. And then they went on to fan out and establish shrimp domestication operations all over Asia. You know, flash, you know, forward ahead a couple decades, and you have now these shrimp growing, you know, sort of empires all over Southeast Asia, you know, billions and billions of pounds of shrimp being produced. And now in America, 90% of the shrimp that we eat is imported. A lot of it is farmed. You know, that is why the shrimp cocktail is no longer the only way you eat shrimp. Now you have it fried, you have it, you know, in gumbos and all kinds of things, but it ain't American.
Is there anything inherently bad about the quality of farmed shrimp as compared to wild shrimp?
You know, from an eating point of view, people in the Gulf, and I spent a lot of time in the Gulf when I was researching this book, will often mockingly call the farmed shrimp, they call it gummy bear shrimp. And that's partly because shrimp and a lot of seafood is treated with a chemical called tripolyphosphate, which causes seafood to retain water, which of course makes it heavier and therefore more valuable per, you know, more of it, so you're actually getting more crop out of everything you harvest. Tripolyphosphates, you know, they're not harmful particularly to humans, but when you cook it, it can give this kind of gummy quality to the texture of the shrimp. From a food safety point of view, you know, it's debatable. The FDA only inspects less than 2% of the seafood that we import, and there are, you know, violations that have occurred, not just with shrimp, but with all seafood coming from abroad, that have to do with, you know, antibiotic residue, some antifungal stuff that you'll, you know, get sprayed into aquaculture pens and so forth. You know, the biggest thing I can say is that we don't really know. There are tens of thousands of little tiny producers of shrimp in Southeast Asia. Nobody has the capacity to inspect these farms. So it's a little bit of a roll of the dice, in my opinion.
And there may be places where it's unethical from a human standpoint. Can you talk about what you discovered in Thailand?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is actually, you know, other people's reporting, but, you know, recently The Guardian did a very, you know, interesting investigation of the Thai shrimp industry. And Thailand, I should note, is the largest provider of foreign shrimp to the United States at this point. So when they investigated the supply chain of the things needed to grow shrimp, and, you know, shrimp are fed a feed that is often derived from wild fish. So right away, this is a little strange, you know, that we're grinding up wild fish to feed shrimp, especially since shrimp in their you know, natural state are actually omnivorous. They'll eat a lot of things. They don't have to eat fish. But in any case, what seems to be happening in Thailand is that these trash fish that are ground up and fed to shrimp are caught by these vessels that it was revealed by The Guardian are impressing slaves to work on the ships. So a certain portion of the stuff that gets fed to shrimp is being caught through the effort, it seems, according to The Guardian, by slave labor. So that was pretty shocking to me. Although there's, you know, other sort of warning signals coming out of the Thai shrimp industry. Last year, a disease called early mortality syndrome hit the Thai shrimp industry, and it wiped out about $1 billion worth of crop. When you get a disease outbreak of that magnitude that is able to kind of sweep over an entire industry, that to me is a red flag about something not going quite right with the industry.
We're a little bit landlocked here in North Texas, but we do love our Gulf shrimp.
Sure.
Talk about some of the threats to that industry and the things that might keep it robust.
Well, so, you know, it's funny. This whole book, American Catch, began as a book about the Gulf oil spill. Mm-hmm. And I had this funny moment where I was out with a shrimper in the middle of the night, and we were talking about the oil spill, and we're kind of running out of things to say about the oil spill because everybody had been, interviewed up to the hilt on this thing. And then finally he turns to me and he says, you know, what's really messing up our market is the importation of foreign shrimp. It's really killing our prices. So there was that, and that led me into this investigation of the whole Gulf shrimp situation. So it turns out not just are their prices being affected, and not only has their reputation been damaged by the Gulf oil spill, but the oil industry, going back much further, has had an impact on the very ecosystems that underpin a lot of shrimp. Shrimp, particularly brown shrimp in Louisiana, depend on the Louisiana marsh in the Mississippi Delta for rearing habitat, for sustenance. It's very, very important. But the oil industry has been active in the Delta, for going on, more than 50 years. And in the process of developing that area as an oil-producing place, the marshes have been canalized, pipelines have been put in. What that does is it allows salt water to inundate freshwater ecosystems or brackish water ecosystems. Once that happens, the plant life that holds the marsh together starts to die, and then you have marshland just dropping away, dropping away, dropping away. So the point where we're losing, thousands and thousands of acres of Mississippi marsh all the time. And if we lose it altogether, we're going to lose a lot of shrimp production down the line.
And one of the things that you're concerned about is that because we're getting all this cheap shrimp from overseas, it's possible not to really notice that there is less Gulf shrimp, less affordable Gulf shrimp out there.
That's right. It's funny. I came to that reflection. I was actually sitting in, one of the numerous BP follow-up hearings where one of the technicians was talking about the night of the spill. Or the blowout, and he's saying how, the warning systems had been disabled, and that's why people didn't hear, what was going on with the rig. I think to some degree what all this foreign imported shrimp does is it disables our warning system. We don't see that we have a serious supply issue, and that we have to really protect, the ecosystems that underpin what is, a truly American food and some would argue our healthiest food.
How careful are U.S. shrimpers about not overfishing and making sure that what they catch remains sustainable based on the current supply?
It's a patchwork. I would like to see the shrimpers get better, particularly in the area of bycatch. When you shrimp, you have to fish with a fairly fine meshed net. Because shrimp are, they're shrimpy, they're small. When you drag a fine mesh net through the water, you're going to have incidental catch, which is called bycatch. Now, there are devices that can reduce that. Turtle excluder devices, or TEDs, are now mandated on many fisheries. There's also something called bycatch reduction devices, or BRDs, which also seem to help the situation. But I think that I think shrimpers could be deploying them more. I think they could be better trained in using them. And I think, fishing is always looked upon as being this sort of, old thing, and we're moving on to other things. But I think there's a lot of sort of new technology, R&D, that could be done around fishing to make it, better, to make it more environmentally sensitive. I think that's we need to put some investment into making our fisheries better.
And let's be clear here, when there is bycatch, it's basically just wasted, right?
Yeah, it's more or less wasted. I mean, there are a couple of efforts. There's a great guy named Jim Gossin in Texas, actually. He's based in the border between Texas and Louisiana, and he has a company called Louisiana Foods. And he started this program called Total Catch, where he markets the bycatch when he can. It's a little bit inconsistent because you have to figure out, the shrimpers have to figure out what to do with it, and then the consumer has to figure out how to cook it. And, a lot of it is edible, but, some of it's small, some of it's bony, And you have to be ready to kind of be a little adventurous with it. But yeah, by and large, bycatch is just dumped overboard. And it's not just shrimp fisheries. You know, we have bycatch issues in long lining for swordfish and tuna. You know, it's one of those issues that it's a dark underbelly of the fishing industry.
By the way, how does a turtle excluder device actually work?
My understanding of it is, you know, and I haven't really, you know, I'm not a net technologist, but I believe it shunts the turtle to one side and keeps it out from going into the back end of the net. But as again, I'm not an engineer.
I didn't realize. I guess I haven't thought about it because I just buy fish and it's already been cut up and it's waiting on ice. But we waste a lot of fish in this country.
We do. We do waste a lot of fish. And actually, I did a demo for the Washington Post recently where a reporter came over to my kitchen and we had a single Gulf Red Snapper. And I got three meals for a family of four out of that one, you know, fairly decent-sized Red Snapper. But, you know, you can eat the head. You can use the rack. You can, you know, I made an Indian poppadom out of the skin. There's all these kinds of things that you can do. You know, unfortunately, Americans are squeamish. You know, the only whole thing they're ready to put on their plate is usually a lobster. Mm-hmm. And even then, they leave a lot of it, you know, untouched. I actually kind of like, you know, it was great for me to spend time in Louisiana and Cajun country where, you know, people really do make use of it and they eat a lot of seafood. But, you know, the head and the tail of a shrimp is all kind of considered fair game down there.
Paul Greenberg is my guest. He is a Pew Fellow in Marine Conservation and a fellow with the Blue Ocean Institute. We're talking about his new book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Paul Greenberg, a Pew Fellow in Marine Conservation and a fellow with the Blue Ocean Institute. His new book is called American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Paul, what makes Alaska such a great place for salmon?
Well, it's a state that has largely been left alone as far as rivers are concerned. You know, if you look at somebody from the Connecticut DEC, Department of Marine Conservation, gave me a map of Connecticut, and it's full of little tiny points on it, and there's literally 3,000 dots on that. Those are all dams. Alaska does not have that situation. They have a lot of free-flowing rivers. You know, rivers that can slip their banks, do whatever they want, and it's great habitat because salmon actually require rivers to spawn. They lay their eggs, and the eggs hatch. The salmon go down the rivers and go out to sea and then come back again. The other thing that Alaska has is pretty good fisheries management. This was not always the case. Back in the 50s, Alaska fisheries, particularly the salmon fisheries, were being hit so hard by companies actually from California that were coming up and stringing nets across the entire mouths of rivers and stopping entire salmon runs. So that there was so much overfishing going on in Alaska that the salmon runs in Alaska got declared a federal disaster area. But once that sort of nadir hit, Alaska, and that was actually one of the reasons that Alaska sued, you know, wanted to get statehood because they wanted to have control over their own fisheries. Once that happened, Those fisheries got rebuilt, and now Alaska salmon runs are actually in pretty good shape.
There, Alaska is also a good place, though, for mining.
Yes, yes, as you know, and it's a, you know, it's very much a frontier place. It's like going back in time, you know, 150 years. So yes, there's a lot of mining going on, and in particular, what's in American Catch is a proposed mine called Pebble Mine, which would be in the headwaters of Bristol Bay. Bristol Bay is the home to the largest sockeye salmon run in the world. Any one time, there's, you know, any one year, anywhere from 20 to 40 million fish come into that system. And nearby Lake Iliamna, which sockeye salmon are sort of unique in that they need a lake in the process of their migration. So Lake Iliamna, which if it were in the lower 48, would be a great lake, at any one time can contain as many as a billion salmon swimming around. Well, anyway, all of that is threatened by this project called Pebble Mine. It is still just an idea, although there's been a lot of exploratory holes drilled into the substrate there. It would be, if it were to go forward, the largest, probably the largest copper and gold mine in North America. Something like 10 billion tons of earth and rock would have to be processed on site. And if you know salmon, you know that they're, you know, they're very sensitive as far as water quality is concerned. It's a real concern, and there's been a real uproar about it in the fishing community to try and stop that mine before it gets permitted.
Does this ultimately come down to which industry is more lucrative?
In a way, it does, but it also is kind of, in a way, which industry is more focused in their lucre. The fishing is a diffuse industry as far as profits are concerned. The Bristol Bay sockeye fishery, from just a sheer pounds perspective, is worth something like $300 to $400 million a year just in profit. Although, you know, if you extrapolate it out, you know, some people argue that overall it's more than $1 billion if you consider all the subsidiary industry that's generated from the fish, you know, everything from the sport fishery to the commercial fishery. The mine and the minerals contained therein are valued at somewhere between $300 to $500 billion, you know, so a couple of orders of magnitude larger. However, once the minerals are gone, you know, and they expect it would take about 80 years to mine it all out, it's gone. And if the fishery gets destroyed in the process, you know, there's no bringing that back. If, however, you amortize out the value of the salmon over, you know, hundreds of years, then it is equal to the value of the mine. But, you know, it's hard to tell shareholders that you'll have to wait several hundred years for a return on your investment. See what I'm saying?
We've had a couple of contacts from people wanting to know about how one can, say, go into a restaurant and make a responsible choice.
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot. First of all, you could, if you want to, you could download the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch app. And, you know, people in the South, in Texas and Louisiana and so forth, find it a little bit confusing because it doesn't address some of the local fishing industries as well as, you know, say it does on the West Coast and the East Coast. So that's one option. But I think, you know, one way to start is to ask your server, if you're in a restaurant, is this seafood that I'm eating American caught or American raised? That's a question that your server should know. And if they don't know it, you know, bug them a little bit. They should know. They should know their sourcing, and they should know, you know, where it's coming from, at least from a country basis. I have given all sorts of recommendations in the past about which seafood you should eat, you know, when, why. But you know, seasons change, populations go up and down, and all we can really hope for is a good regulatory environment. And I know and believe that the United States has good fishing regulations, has good safety regulations as far as seafood is concerned. So I would first and foremost ask that your catch be American caught.
So I'll confess, my husband and I had a little date last night and had sashimi for dinner. It was delicious, but it was imported from Japan.
I'm sure.
Should I avoid that? Or for, say, things like sushi, is it okay to you know, go with more
exotic? Was it tuna?
There was a whole selection of delicious things. tuna was among them.
Well, first of all, I didn't ask your server, but you know, just because it's sushi doesn't mean it's from Japan.
No, it was on the menu.
Oh, it clearly said it was from. Oh, that's unusual. You know, what can I say? There are certainly well-managed fisheries internationally, and certain countries do better than others. Norway, New Zealand, Australia, Iceland, these are all countries that have, you know, good fisheries management practices. Japan has a lot of issues. You know, I was just actually at the a conference of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and a delegation of journalists and fisheries managers came to there, and we had a very interesting discussion. And, you know, there was real concern amongst Japanese, these are professionals who know the fishing industry, that they are with their fisheries management right now in Japan where we were 30 years ago. Mm. In other words, they're just really starting to see this, we've got a serious problem on our hands. We have to turn around and be much more conservative in how we're managing our fish. So Japan, I think there are some environmental concerns about seafood coming from Japan. Other countries around the world, it just depends on, you know, different countries do better and other countries do worse.
Well, I wish it weren't true, but I'm glad I know now. So thank you for that. Let's go to the phone. We have Ed on the line in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Maybe a guest would care to comment on the state of bluefin tuna. It's my understanding there's a population of bluefin tuna that live in the Gulf of Mexico, perhaps even in Texas waters, and that they migrate to the Mediterranean Sea. I don't know if it's just once or repeatedly, but they're harvested over there, and maybe that's a stock that we could do more to protect here in our waters.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, excellent question. Yeah, bluefin tuna do, in fact, cross the Atlantic. There are three species of bluefin. There's Atlantic, Pacific, and Southern. But the Atlantic bluefin that you're talking about does, in fact, come into the Gulf of Mexico. A portion of the there's a western stock and an eastern stock, and the western stock spawns in the Gulf of Mexico, and the eastern stock spawns in the Mediterranean. But they do intermix, sometimes as much as 50%. And you know, in this country, the bluefin tuna situation is complicated because a lot of the bluefin that get killed as a result of that bycatch issue we were talking about. People are out there in the Gulf long lining for yellowfin tuna, which, you know, aren't really in an overfishing situation in the Gulf. They're long lining for swordfish, and in the process they're killing bluefin tuna that, you know, go for the same bait. So there's been a big fight about that. Meanwhile, like in the Northeast, there's a very small amount. Those of you might have seen that National Geographic show Wicked Tuna. And those guys are all catching bluefin on rod and reel one at a time, and they consider their fishery to be really sustainable. Well, yeah, but then there's this overall question of the quota, and if a huge portion of the quota is being killed by bycatch, do we need to either limit the rod and reel guys up north, or do we need to shut down the yellowfin fishery because it's doing undue damage to the bluefin fishery? And then there's a whole other issue of the Mediterranean, where you have 23 different nations fishing on bluefin in the Mediterranean in an environment that's very, very hard to regulate. So, you know, these kind of highly migratory fish, like the bluefin tuna, are definitely fish that, you know, you have to be really careful about, and they are subject to the vagaries of the international market.
What should we think about if we're in the market for canned fish, tuna, salmon, sardines, that sort of thing?
Well, so one thing that I kind of think is a great ignored seafood is canned salmon. You know, some people don't like it so much because in America anyway, the canned product often comes with skin and bone. And it's not that its skin and bone isn't edible. Actually, when you can salmon, it's, you know, they literally cut these vertical slices through the fish and then put it in a can and cook it to the point where the skin and the bone dissolve and soften up to the point you can eat them. I think that canned salmon is a great product. It's high in omega-3s. It doesn't have the mercury issues that some canned tuna can have. So I often say, you know, if you're going to have a sort of tuna salad sandwich, why not try a salmon salad sandwich? And we know it's an American product. I also, you know, I eat a lot of sardines and anchovies, and those make ecological sense because, you know, those smaller fish tend to be more numerous. But one really crazy thing about the American seafood industry is that we have lots of sardines and anchovies in our waters, and we do catch them, but mostly what they get used for is bait. And the canned anchovies and sardines that we have in this country are mostly imported.
I was surprised to learn about the relationship between Chinese scallops and Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, right? That's crazy. Yeah, so in 1982, a Chinese aquaculture scientist was invited to the United States, and he ended up at Tisbury Pond, you know, not far from probably where President Obama will take his vacation. And there in that pond, they were raising domesticated bay scallops. And Dr. Zhang took, I think, 120 of them back to Qingdao in China. Along the way, 94 of them died or something like that. 26 survived. And those 26 were raised in Qingdao and turned into a multi-million dollar scallop industry, a large portion of which, or a certain portion of which anyway, got exported back to the United States. So I always like to say this, the Martha's Vineyard scallops left Martha's Vineyard because they couldn't afford the real estate, and they went to China instead.
All right. So any thoughts as to choosing fish? First of all, you lament the fact that fish markets, specialized fish markets, are starting to disappear.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's another thing I would say, you know, if for people are looking to improve their fish buying practices, try to go to a fish market rather than a supermarket. You know, used to be fish markets and fishmongers dominated the seafood trade. You know, more than 70% of seafood 25 years ago was sold in fish markets, and, you know, much less sold in supermarkets. Now it's completely flipped, and the majority of the seafood trade is happening in supermarkets, which is not to say that supermarkets don't have good buying practices. Whole Foods in particular, Wegmans, a couple other chains, you know, have really tried to have good seafood sourcing policies. But I love individual fishmongers, and I feel that they tend to be more in touch with what's really going on in local waters. They're more apt to have local fish, I think. I can't scientifically prove that, but just my casual conversations with fishmongers versus people just working in the counter at a supermarket seem to imply to me that your average fishmonger is a little more informed.
Are we better off with something that has never been frozen, or does it make a difference?
Well, you know, it's not nutritionally. It does make a difference nutritionally. I think that they're well-frozen fish. If it's treated right, can come out perfectly fine. Like Alaska salmon, for example, most of it is frozen right there at the plant. And so even if you go into, say, a Whole Foods and you see salmon on ice in February, for example, there's not very much chance that that is actually fresh. Mm-hmm. It was probably defrosted and put on ice. So rather than get the, you know, defrosted salmon on ice at the market, better just to go to the freezer case and get the salmon that has been frozen all along, and defrost it carefully in your refrigerator and then eat it. And I don't think you'll find it too much different from the fresh, although, you know, fresh has a certain appeal.
Paul Greenberg is a Pew Fellow in Marine Conservation and a fellow with the Blue Ocean Institute. His new book is called American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Paul, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.